Welcome to the third episode of London Digital Nattering. In this special extended edition, I'm joined by Matteo Placesi, Head of Marketing and Communications at the Design Museum. Originally from Italy, Matteo came to London in 2006 to do a Master's in Arts Management at the University of Greenwich and settled here afterwards. Matteo has been working in marketing for the past 11 years through music, theatre, festivals and exhibitions. Matteo arrived at the studio to record this session having just come out of a meeting to review the success of a recent exhibition he promoted called Ferrari Under the Skin, which attracted over 100,000 visitors to the Design Museum. Matteo is here in personal capacity and does not represent the Design Museum today. We talk about the arts, culture and entertainment industry in London and its European context, which leads on inevitably to our secondary topic of Brexit. So, get a brew on, sit back, enjoy the show. Hello, Matteo.
Hello, Kieran.
Thanks very much for coming into the studio today. How are you doing?
I'm all right. Thank you for inviting me.
You are the Head of Marketing and Communications, or just Head of Communications?
I'm Head of Marketing and Communications.
Ooh, but, yeah. Okay. And that's at the Design Museum, no less.
Yeah, in London, in Kensington.
Okay, cool. So you've just had a very busy day. You've come back, you've come in to the studio from a session talking about the latest exhibition that you've been running.
Yeah, an exhibition that closed in April, mm-hmm. Which was the, the best, you know, it's kind of the best selling, biggest exhibition the museum has ever done. So obviously we have a lot of to analyze and discuss,
cool,
and learn for the future.
Cool. That sounds very digital. Analyzing, discussing, learning,
yeah,
planning for the future.
Yeah, that's what I try to do.
Yeah. Cool. So we're here today to talk about a couple of topics. So the first one, the big topic, is digital transformation in arts, culture, and entertainment.
Yep.
And we'll be also digging into the happy, happy topic of Brexit afterwards.
Just can't get enough of it.
Just can't get enough of that Brexit. Gotta love the Brexit. So just for those listening, what do we even mean by arts, culture and entertainment? And how can it even be digital?
So what we mean for, I think there's kind of a distinction. So you got arts and culture sector and kind of arts and culture products, shall we say, which are events, or which could be, you know, music, film, exhibitions, so art, visual arts, and performance in general. And these are experiences and products that, to define, they sort of add, every time you experience them, they add an extra block of knowledge, or kind of they enrich you as a human being in a way, and as well as, you know, sometimes, most of the times, entertaining as well. While entertainment is much more looking at the commercial world of, again, music, film, theatre, and these are mostly sort of pleasurable, you know, experiences, and it's some, and they give you something that you already like, you know, a lot, and they keep on giving that. But the main drive for that is commercial, right? For the arts culture is more of a humanist, I guess.
Okay,
if that's a word. Output.
So there's a kind of what you're drawing a distinction between here. It seems to be a low culture and a high culture. Like that's how I think people used to refer to it decades ago.
I would say, yeah, popular mm-hmm. culture, entertainment, and I would say just culture in the other end. It is not really, it's not really high or low. It's just sort of different. I know what you mean. Yeah, and yeah. Yes, the answer is yes. But but to me, it's more like it's just a different output.
I was gonna dig a little bit more into that. You know, this definition rather than using the words low or high in terms of culture, mm. Not to use those seems a bit more egalitarian and a bit more respectful of
yeah.
just just, it is what it is. Yeah. Art for the sake of art, right?
Well, there's art for the sake of art, and which to some people actually could appear as a elitist in a way, and I guess putting the artist up on a pedestal. But I like the most, and that's why I like, well, I work in the sector. I'm not an artist myself. It's more like the audience development and trying to be a service for a purpose, you know, using these media, you know, and art forms for a purpose for society.
So the society is the purpose. What is the effect? What is that purpose doing?
So I guess there's been a lot of there's been sort of decades now of debate and discussion about the impact and the purpose, right, of the arts in particular, and most recently there have been quite a few studies, and there are, you know, there's been trying to quantify the economic impact, okay, for example, mm-hmm, of cultural organizations, of the creative industries in general, and also the social impact, right? So try to put a number on one, and then try to paint a wider picture of the benefits of arts and culture, and these go from mental health,
yep,
to pure
when we say more, so there's mental health, which is a kind of an intangible benefit,
yeah,
hopefully measurable by, you know, fewer people going into hospital or requiring, yeah, treatment,
yeah,
I don't know, maybe that can be measured, yeah. And then presumably the other thing is some kind of tangible economic output,
yeah, but then also on the social elements that you've got, you know, the educational aspect to it, and yeah, on the economic, there's all the economy strictly related to the product produced, and also like all around it, like, you know, the way. So there's been in 2012, the City of London Corporation commissioned a study on the economic and social impact of the cultural organizations within the square mile, for example.
Oh, right. Wow.
That was published in 2013, and we can put a link on okay, your website.
Yeah, there'll be show notes published at the end of this. Yeah.
And that assessed quite thoroughly. So the cultural organizations in the square mile are, you know, the Barbican Centre, the Museum of London, the London, the City of London Festival, which actually doesn't exist anymore, things like that. And they assessed that the impact was, they contributed the gross value added, which is an economic indicator, was about £230 million a year to the square mile.
Wow.
Which actually, if I remember correctly, was more in terms of net contribution to the economy of the City of London, was actually more than what banks contribute, because, because obviously, you know, I guess banks are here because they don't really pay that much taxes. or don't contribute as much to the community, so it's a real benefit for the City of London, and also and then that includes hotels, and, you know, because obviously these organizations, these programs create an opportunity to visit, you know, rather than just working in that location. Then the Creative Industries Federation recently published the impact, the economic impact, and again the gross value added of the creative industries in.
So I might be able to help you with the stats here.
Yeah.
91.8 billion in 2016. That is UK wide, I think.
Yeah.
And the mind blowing stat here is that it's larger than automotive, life sciences, aerospace, oil and gas, even combined. That is nuts.
Yep. So 91.8 billion. Yep. So you can see, I mean, there's an understanding already that from politicians, from local authorities and the government, that on on a certain level, there's an understanding that there's a real contribution, and the return on the investment is much higher, actually, than other sectors. But parallel to that, there's kind of a under constant sort of endemic underfunding of the sector,
right?
From which is a sector that does need government, local, like public support and funding to exist because of the nature of it.
And then I noticed on some of the stats that we looked at earlier that we have the largest player, regionally in this is the Southeast, presumably mostly London, right?
London, yeah.
Yeah. So just as well, we've got this on London Digital Nattering.
There you go.
So, so we're talking about the output. So now the input is constrained. You were starting to talk there about funding being constrained.
Yeah, funding seems to be, public funding always seems too little across the sector. It's interesting to note that I think the statistic from the Creative Industries Federation mentioned that about half or over half of actually the businesses in the creative industries are small businesses with less than 10 employees. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about a very fragmented, kind of small scale businesses. And then you've got the big kind of national organizations, and the way, maybe taking a step back, the way organizations in the sector are usually funded, so number one, they're funded directly by the Department of Media, Sports and Culture, and these are, for example, the national museums, like, mm-hmm. you know, the Victoria and Albert Museum, the Science Museum, and mm-hmm. Organizations funded regularly with kind of 3-year or 5-year agreements through the Arts Council, which is an independent body that gets money from the government, and then through they have their own policy in terms of allocating funds. So you've got organizations funded by the Arts Council, like the Royal Opera House. Then the Arts Council also gives out money for projects. So actually most of these players in the sector will apply for money for specific projects, okay. rather than having, you know, a stability, a kind of long-term funding.
Right.
And then you got subjects that, you know, they just privately funded. They get little or no money from the government. So for example, the museum where I work is one of them. Sort of design museum.
Oh, okay. I didn't know. I took it for granted that it was a publicly. I just figured all museums are publicly funded.
No, it gets just 2% of its okay. operative income.
Is it free admission into the design museum?
The design museum is free to enter, and there's a free permanent display, yeah. Which is actually for the first time since. In its history, it started having that with when it moved to Kensington in 2016.
Okay.
And then as ticketed temporary exhibitions.
Ah, right. And that's for example, the ticketed one is the one that you're talking about. We were talking about earlier about Ferrari.
Yeah.
Okay. So you've got DCMS, Arts Council, private funding.
Yeah.
The Arts Council presumably is lottery money.
It's lottery money.
Lottery money. Yeah.
And then you got the Lottery Heritage Fund that is a separate body that okay. funds capital projects mainly. Right. So the Design Museum was funded at a contribution because it was a big kind of, I think over £80 million kind of development to move into the Commonwealth Institute, the building that used to be the Commonwealth Institute. So a part of that budget was covered by the Lottery Heritage Fund.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. So I imagine tons and tons of people involved in applying for grants, all of that great stuff.
Yeah, there's a whole bureaucracy that goes with it, obviously. But going back to the funding, it's always struck me as weird that there's this clear understanding in certain circles, at least, that, you know, there's a big contribution and there's a huge multiplier for society and the economy in funding the arts and culture. But when you go and talk about budgets and money, it's always less and less. And actually, it's been cut in the past 10 years, and particularly when, you know, with the Tory government, they've been pushing, let's say, towards a more, in their view, I guess, a more entrepreneurial way of operating for these organizations, which means that they have to get more money in commercially. So okay. Either through admissions or through fundraising or the commercial branches, so in terms of retail or hiring spaces or things like that. So a bigger percentage of their budget needs to come, their income needs to come from these diversified sort of sources.
Cool. So I'd really like to talk about that fragmentation and pseudo competition inside the industry a bit later on, because I think there are some benefits and disbenefits from that.
Yeah.
So, hey, the part of the key topic is digital. So how does digital touch this, and specifically digital transformation? Like, first off, what do we mean by digital transformation?
To me, digital transformation means that, you know, like you said at the beginning, you know, like, you know, we're looking back at an exhibition that's closed, and we analyze and discuss, and so we look at the data, we analyze and learn. And that's really the approach, I think, that comes with the digital approach, and the way mm-hmm. that I think organizations need to think from the... So have the infrastructure in place to measure, and measure more and more with the tools available, measure actual behavior, and rather than, you know, to accompany qualitative research, but you've got many more tools to learn more from the quantitative as well. So the really is that approach that starts from the data and having the tools to analyze the data, and then change the way you do things accordingly. So one effect of one consequence of, you know, this drive to get more money from commercial sources or admissions is that actually the programs can become more populist, you know, mm-hmm. and go towards the commercial, kind of purely in some sort of entertainment world, which, you know, to cash in on things that we know the audience likes. Right?
Okay, so that's back to that continuum between kind of like art and culture at the, I feel bad even saying it, at the high end, and then the entertainment at the low end, right?
Yeah.
Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Populist.
Yeah. And so it doesn't mean that you just need to. So you learn from the data, and then you just deliver whatever the audience only what the you know is gonna sell. Basically, you know.
Yeah.
It means that you learn. It's a more nuanced approach where you got more sophisticated data, which means that you can better reach and engage on more difficult topics, for example, and you can effectively develop an audience. And really, what the key here is this audience development drive, because what really attracted me. So I'm Italian, and. What really attracted me to come and work here was that when I was studying, I studied arts management in Italy and here, that there was this real clear policy here that, you know, if all this work is funded by the taxpayer, then there's a drive to make it as accessible as possible, because everyone is contributing to it, so everyone should be able to access it. And that means that you move from something that is purely intellectual to something that is intelligent, you know?
Nice.
And inclusive.
Yeah.
Right? And audience development, it's part of that. So why digital, it's a big part of that, because it lets you learn more, and then it lets you have more effective ways to reach and engage, which means you, in the long term, you can develop that audience.
So in terms of audience development, is what the policy and the tax policy is trying to do, is that about trying to get more and more audience penetration into the arts and culture end, but in a more accessible way that makes sense to people? Is that what that's supposed to do?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's the key. And obviously that's only part of the picture, because you know, at some point, you know, one of the biggest insights in decades of research is that if someone is not interested in something, that they're just not interested. Yeah. Years and years and decades of research.
Have you ever seen that happen with any of your projects?
Yeah, all the time. Yeah. Well, I mean, because, you know, there's a big drive, you know, the Arts Council, and obviously, you know, there's a big drive to engage with audiences that have low cultural engagement, as they are defined, and particularly from ethnic minorities in the population, in deprived areas, you know. And sometimes it's really just a matter of, you know, going in those communities with something that they can connect with, which is part of it is that they like, you know, and also it's part of their culture, you know, rather than bring in a different culture in and kind of, you know, force them to listen to Beethoven, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So yeah, I've seen it plenty of times now that, you know, there's all this work on trying to sell and shape something for those audiences, like low cultural engagement audiences, that has nothing to do with them, and it's treated as just a pure marketing effort.
So,
and that never works.
So we talked about the economic value. I'm putting my cynical hat on now, yeah? So we talked about the economic value of the sector, but why would the government want the proletariat to embrace culture? Do you know what I mean? Why would they want the proles listening to, well, whatever, Beethoven or looking at ballet?
Well, I guess it depends who's in government.
Yeah.
Number one. Yeah. I mean, that was a big drive from, particularly from, I think, 1997. And obviously, you know, so I think it was a big part initially of labor policy. Mm-hmm. But then you get people who work in the arts and people who are in those kind of policymaking, you know, roles as well. They're that, for luckily, they're that kind of person who understands that that culture is good for society as a whole. It makes better citizens, like well-rounded, critical citizens that are tolerant, you know, respectful, and mentally stable, balanced, and all of that. Better productive, you know, there's all that. And more knowledgeable, you know.
And there's evidence for stuff like the productivity and the crime reduction or social behavior.
I think there are, I mean, there's certainly a link, and there are studies about, you know, with, you know, the kind of culture offering in certain areas and the way people, there was recently actually, and you have to excuse me, but I'm not 100% sure it was real, because I just saw it on Facebook.
Yeah.
And someone I trust shared it, but you never know these days.
Yeah.
And the recent elections in Italy. And there was this correlation between the fact, so in areas where, in like small towns, where there wasn't even a cinema,
yeah,
right, voted overwhelmingly for the right.
Interesting.
Right. And now I don't know if it's just a correlation because it's a small town and kind of, you know, you get a certain type of person. I don't know. But the fact that there was no cultural offering, even just because the cinema is actually everywhere in a way. I mean, less so these days, but, so there was that. And so the less culture, the more intolerant, basically. they were. And I guess the less informed, you know, because they weren't worse people, I guess. But all I'm saying is, if you don't have the opportunity to access something that explains the world to you and the complexity, it cuts through the complexity in an emotional and intelligent way, you know, and gives you the instruments to understand what's going on in a very, I mean, complex world. I mean, massively confusing for everyone. That has an impact. So yeah, it depends on who's in government, because then you also have, you know, the, you know, people who just like to preserve a certain type of, as you say, high culture, the way they see it, the way it is, and just fund it purely as a museum in a way, in the worst possible meaning of museum, which is just a place where you just store stuff, keep it there to dust, you know, to gather dust. And while the other end and the best possible way to kind of describe the museum is that preserves the memory, but uses this memory to affect the present and make you understand the present, and lets you use it for that purpose. But I mean, it goes back to the commune experiment in Paris. It's like in 19th century, you know, it was the city against the countryside. It's kind of a thread throughout history. And maybe, yeah, you can get it down to this lack of... Because at the end of the day, a lack of culture is a lack of understanding, like in the most basic sense, right? Meaning. And obviously, you know, it's easy for us to say because we think we're right. So. So we think we understand.
I think this is where we put in the perspective disclaimer, folks. Okay.
But yeah, so that's the value. And why a government would invest in it beyond. Although then at the end, you know, this argument was made for a long time, but then someone had to really go and with a calculator and just count the beans, you know what I mean? And go, okay, guys, we've been beating around the bush for a while now. This is actually our contribution to the economy. And everybody pays attention all of a sudden.
Even if that number is impossible to measure.
Exactly.
But it's written down, so it must be true.
Exactly.
Okay, so we talked a little bit about digital. We summarized that as a mindset kind of thing and a process of looking and using it, using data, looking at data, experimentation, learning, right?
Yeah, testing things and eventually towards developing the audience.
Why even bother with any digital like technology approaches? What are the problems that you're trying to solve in the industry? I mean, you are not the whole industry, obviously, but in your professional experience.
I think the number one... Well, so I obviously talk about the communication side of things, so the marketing and PR side of things.
Yeah.
So in that respect, there was a problem of, this still to some extent is, a problem of feedback, right, from the audience, because you're talking to a mass of people and you're not talking to individuals, and you need to learn who they are and what they want, what they like, what they understand, what they don't understand. Secondly, there was a problem of reach, effective reach of these people. We're talking, you know, going back to the funding, you know, we're talking about organizations that don't have millions of pounds to spend on advertising. Everything needs to be with the minimum wastage, you know, communication needs to be very targeted and effective to small budgets we're talking about.
Okay.
So digital helped an awful lot with that. And then I guess the third one was this opportunity to cut the middleman on some level, which is what actually has been extensively talked about with, you know, the artist now being directly in touch with the fan, that kind of phenomenon where you don't need you know, you don't need a journalist in the middle anymore to be able to communicate with your fan base, that sort of thing.
Do you need a PR person still?
Well, the PR person you need now has changed a bit, because before it was just the PR person was, you know, he was keeping the relationships with the journalists and editors and then sending out writing and sending out information that, that they would use to create their own content, or as a initial stimulus to then be interested and then, I don't know, come down and produce content, different content about it. Now that PR person also produces content. Which is the organization or the artists themselves producing this content and then distributing it through these platforms. So there's a slight change, and also there's a this new figure that's exploded into the scene, the digital scene, which is the influencer, which is this you know, these people on that have built a huge following on social media, and they are a new type of middleman, kind of intermediary, that you can use, you can build a relationship with, and then to reach their audience, because they've built these this audience, and you use them to reach, to act, get access to it. But at the same time, now you have the opportunity to build your own audience directly, and to build this what I would call a valuable niche based on specific interests and based on what you're producing, you know, as an organization, as an artist, and long term kind of try to grow and grow and grow and grow this niche that brings in enough value to your organization to survive and keep doing what you're doing and do it better and better and enlarging that base.
Okay. So so your role as communications guru, are you an influencer? Are you the PR guy? Are you the, would you say, where would you, do you fit in any box?
I am, I'm across the whole spectrum. I'm not an influencer. No. I don't have many followings on Instagram.
Well, you will soon.
I barely use Instagram.
Our whole dozen listeners will, I'm sure, subscribe.
Yeah, I was one of those ones who signed up to Facebook back when it was still, you still needed a university email. Do you remember that? To subscribe.
Wow.
2006.
Wow. Okay.
But I'm across it, and there's this thing now, and this goes back again to digital, is the T-shaped marketeer. The T-shaped is kind of the little stick of the, like the vertical stick of the T is the vertical line is sort of depth, yeah, in-depth knowledge of one particular field or discipline within the field. And then we got the T, the horizontal one, which is a knowledge, kind of a general, like a, you know, not as in depth, but a clear knowledge of all the other bits,
yeah,
that affect your the output ultimately. So that's what I'm going for.
Yeah. I mean, the T-shaped thing resonates because that's what we, you know, in my team try and hire for, you know. People are maybe very, very good at product consulting or product design who can also do some delivery stuff, you know, delivery management on top. So totally get that. So what has the impact been of new tech on the sector? You know, the race, what's the arms race here?
So what's interesting about it is the sector... So there was very little innovation. There has been very little innovation that came from the sector itself. What happened is that tech companies have disrupted the whole sector, including their own sectors, yeah, and have sort of imposed new technology and new channels and new ways of doing things. And then the sector had to catch up. To learn these technologies and learn these new ways of doing things and then apply them to what they were doing.
Okay.
And obviously it all started with you know, Napster for the music business, for the music industry, right?
Absolutely.
So all of a sudden, that was a software. That was a piece of software that changed forever the way that music, the music business was conducted for a very long time. To the point that these days, you know, and the whole form, you know, the album format is being kind of archived in a way, or less in the future. But so that's when it started. So that's what happened. So technology kind of crashed into the sector on all levels, more or less, and throughout the years, starting really with music. So there was this catching up to do, but then also there was this great opportunity all of a sudden that I mentioned before, which was, okay, we got this great access now to our audiences, this direct access. And then the next kind of disruption was for the advertising industry, again, which is part of creative industries.
Yeah.
That meant that before you had all these different players and it was very fragmented and you had like magazines. Remember those magazines? that, you know, were cultivating an audience.
Yeah.
And then you would advertise on it to reach that audience. You know, you would put a full page ad in there and people would read it. And all of a sudden, the field was left with mainly sort of Facebook and Google as the two big players in it, because what they did is they built this very sophisticated technology again that lets you target people to advertise, to promote stuff to them, to sell them stuff in a way that's so much more accurate.
Yeah.
And was based on, for the first time, was based on their actual behavior online, which admittedly, obviously, they were spying effectively by tracking behavior online. So you could target people by their interests. So the interests of meaning that the things they've been talking about online, or they've been browsing online, or they've been buying online. With a much more cost effective format and much more just effective formats, like, you know, native formats, like, you know, Google search. That looks, the ads look exactly like the organic searches for years, actually. People, I mean, to this day, there are people that don't know the difference. They search for something and the top, they get three ads and they look like search results and they click on them.
Often with catastrophic results for them, you know, like these interloper things, these interloper services trying to sell you visas.
All sorts of stuff. And Facebook the same, you know, the ads on Facebook or Instagram now, and they look exactly the same as any other post. So that makes it much more effective because, you know, there's extensive research on the fact that people don't really see digital banners on websites.
Yeah.
I mean, we've been sort of blind to them for a long time now. So there's that. And then the next one was mobile, the next disruption. So mobile meant that you could, so you have these people carrying around these devices and carrying around this opportunity to be reached the whole time throughout the day, right? So you could do that kind of very targeted, you could have that very targeted approach at scale.
Yeah.
Right? Which makes it much more effective. Combined with the fact that the price of that advertising inventory was right, in a way. It was very low. While publishers normally charge, in my experience, a bit too much compared to what you get back.
Tell us more about that.
No, it's just, so there's a whole, sense of so when you're buying inventory directly from a publisher, you're buying prime inventory, right? So what Google did, this was Google with the Google Ad Exchange, what they did is they found a way to monetize the long tail of web traffic, right? So what do you do is you have access to all these placements that before publishers weren't able to sell because it was just not enough of it in one website.
Yeah.
You know, so you're talking about a very small amount of impressions on a page that very few people obviously visit, mm-hmm. right? But that doesn't matter when you have a network of millions of those websites. So millions of those pages with little, small hits, small amount of hits,
yeah.
but still hits. So a small amount of hits multiplied by millions,
yeah.
it's millions of, hundreds of millions of hits and yeah. impressions that you can now sell, right? So that's what Google did, because it doesn't matter. Like and that was part of, in a way, the fourth disruption, the fourth revolution in a way, which was programmatic buying. Programmatic buying is an automated way of buying advertising inventory online by targeting an audience, you know, with certain characteristics across the web and across mobile applications, rather than just targeting a specific context, meaning a page on a website or a section of a website.
Yeah.
Right. So what that does is you're targeting this person online, not this website. And if that person happens to be at the time you're advertising and you're in the place with a small amount of hits, but is the right person, you're targeting that person. So that's valuable to you all of a sudden.
Right? Yeah.
It doesn't matter that that person is on a prime section of the site or not, because all it matters is that you're targeting that person.
So this is really taking to the extreme, trying to solve John Wanamaker's problem, the advertiser. Half the money I spend on advertising is wasted. The trouble is I don't know which half.
Yeah.
So... this is really taking to the extreme. You've gone through like four different. So there was going backwards, programmatic, which is where you're yeah. targeting an individual, irrespective of where they're at.
Well, I'm talking about individual, but let's clarify. I mean, you're not actually targeting an individual because
uh-huh.
it's all anonymous data. First of all, before we get in trouble with GDPR.
Oh yeah, sorry about that.
You know, everybody's going to be is being bombarded by emails from companies that they never subscribe to, asking them to. Oh, by the way, the European Union is going to sue us if.
So I've actually noticed. I don't know if you have, but I've noticed the thing about these GDPR emails, right? So some emails I get are, "Hi, Kieran.
Yeah.
You're on our mailing list. Okay, well, we'd like you to click this button just to see if you'd be still interested in receiving stuff from yeah. us." And that's great. Those are my favorite emails because mostly I ignore them. So I'm not going to click on the button.
That, you know what that means?
Mm-hmm.
The back end, that means, oh, look, we've got Kieran on this list. We have no idea how he got here.
Yeah. Oh, is that what that means?
Throughout all these years, we don't know if it's just because he bought something from us and then... We didn't ask him, but we put it on our newsletter, you know,
yeah.
and then we just send him email. We started sending him emails and he never unsubscribed. So that's what it means. Or if he actually gave us consent initially and subscribed to his newsletter.
Oh no,
so we don't know.
We better find out.
We better check.
So I get those ones. The next one I get is, "Hey, Kieran, you're on our mailing list. We'd like to keep sending you stuff. Click here if you would like to opt out." So the first one is an opt-in email. The second one is an opt-out email. And then there's a third one where I just keep getting emails.
Regardless. Okay. So yeah, programmatic, where you're targeting, let's say, a group of people, like
yeah.
a group of people with certain characteristics
yeah.
across the web. Then you got mobile.
Yeah.
And then you got Facebook and Google.
Yeah.
So the targeting and the formats and the price.
Yeah.
Price is very important because they made it really accessible for small and medium businesses to manage this themselves as well. So they gave access to something that was very sophisticated and normally a private corporation would develop for themselves and then sell for a lot of money to customers to use. They just made it free to use on a commission base, obviously, by buying advertising through their exchange, and very easy to use as well.
Yeah.
And then you got at the beginning, going to the beginning of this, the tech disruption that was brought into the industry, into the sector by external forces, which were tech companies that were disrupting other sectors with it.
It's funny looking back and thinking about all this. It's unrecognizable compared to how it was 20 years ago.
Yeah, 10 years ago.
Even 10 years ago.
I mean, 5 years ago, marketing-wise, yeah. 3 years ago.
And you mentioned Napster, and I'm sure there are people listening to this going, what was Napster? Who's Napster? You know, even.
I think it still exists.
Does it?
I think, because they sold it. Somebody bought Napster at some point.
I would
thinking,
like to know.
This is a great business opportunity. Pirate software.
Yeah.
Piracy software. And then I'm going to start selling this music without having licenses.
Yeah, great. Anyway. Good skills.
But I was reading, today there was an article, I didn't read the article, I just read the title on The Guardian. There are some people still using MySpace.
Oh?
Remember MySpace?
They went through a reskin. They went through an attempted relaunch on MySpace, yeah. Confession time. When they relaunched MySpace, I thought, let's have a look at this. So I actually went on and made a page and then just deleted it because I couldn't see the point. So lots of change coming into the sector, lots of new things happening, presumably lots of technology people moving into nicely well-paid jobs with all that lucrative funding going into the arts, culture and entertainment sector. maybe not. How has this stuff gotten traction? How have things changed? How have things been able to change, I guess, is my puzzle.
There's still a lot of work to be done, actually, because, parts of the industry have been so just unable or unwilling to move along, to move with it for a long time. Mm. The music, the whole music business, they try to just stop time.
Uh-huh. And just, oh, you mean with like the rights management?
And refused to acknowledge that the times were moving with or without them.
Yeah.
So they wasted a lot of.
So you're referring to things like the rights management. I mean, so my experience of trying to use music back then was, do you know what? Not that I ever did. For the record, it would be easier to obtain music by piracy than it would be to use your service.
Yeah. And then you got the Spotify's and all that that revolutionized, legalized the. Legalize it. But part of that, and you mentioned, so again, going back to the funding and to all these, so with technology and with more sophisticated tools and ways of doing things and more analytical approach and all of that, comes greater complexity and a need to train people, you know, and to have, more, specialists, and different skills, more very sought after skills, and with it so comes a big skills shortage in the industry because again these roles are not as well paid as in other industries, a lot of it is through it's kind of civil service or like government funded, again lesser paid jobs, so all of a sudden you need these massive operation in a way. Like we talk about, so data is, it's been a buzzword for a long time, but data, what is data? Data is simply the audience, right? Yeah. The way I look at it, it's anonymous data with interests and demographic traits and behaviors attached to it, right? So to manage that data, to get the insight, to reach it, you need complex systems like IT systems, you need customer relationship management systems, mm-hmm. that some of which are big, there's no...
And not cheap.
Not right? cheap, expensive.
Yeah.
The system itself. There's a problem with in this skills shortage and this lack of knowledge. There's, you need consultants all of a sudden.
God forbid, consultants. Yeah.
You need consultants that... they lack another set of skills, in my experience, which is because the money has never been really in culture. Like, you don't go into culture to make money. Let's face it. So they never really had to deal with that sector before, right? They deal with, you know, pharmaceutical or government or whatever, you know, business that have real money. So they come in with a lack of understanding of the sector. There's a lack of understanding on one side on what is good for them. So in terms of what we need in terms of technological, the technical input. And on the other side, there's a lack of understanding of what they actually need, because you've got this vast realm of possibilities with these tools, that very intelligent tools, automation, you know, machine learning, AI, now we're talking about. And they don't even know what the basics are that are needed in these sectors. So everything becomes so complex. And there's a lot of work to be done, and obviously slows everything down as well, because the process takes a long time to get right, because, you know, you fail a couple of times because, you know, there's this lack of connection basically from the two parts. There's a lot of money that gets wasted in a way throughout the years. There's still a problem even training that staff, even just to operate these systems, because the background is different. You know, as I said, you know, you go into culture for different reasons. You don't go into culture to run. Normally, you don't really go into that sector and start working in it because you want to run a tight business. That's not what you had in mind.
You join it to be a creative person, right?
Yeah, to be a creative person, or because you believe in the product, you really have a big, deep connection with the product. So it gets very difficult to fill those roles, to get those T-shaped people.
Yeah.
That I already know are even difficult to recruit in other sectors where the money is. Let alone where there is no money, like when, you know, there are some people in these organizations that are, you know, get paid kind of entry level jobs. They pay £16,000 a year in London.
Yeah.
It's impossible to live on that.
Yeah.
It's impossible. Yeah. Which brings in a whole new layer of complexity, which is, so only a certain kind of person can do those jobs, can take those jobs. Which are people that are from a middle class background that can afford to get, you know, have their family backing them, and they don't need to earn money really to live for a few years before they'd actually have to. While other people from more deprived backgrounds, they just can't afford it.
So basically wages are being subsidized by families, the banker mum and dad. And you see that phenomenon in acting. There was I saw a narrative buzzing around a few months ago, you know.
Yeah.
Benedict Cabbage Patch.
Who is a hero, by the way? I don't know if you heard that. He stopped in Marylebone, like near Marylebone High Street. He stopped four guys who were beating up a Deliveroo driver.
Did he?
Right, yeah.
Okay.
With a taxi driver.
I will no longer jokingly refer to Benedict Cumberbatch by anything other than Benedict Cumberbatch.
He's a hero.
Yeah. And Eddie Redmayne, right? And other people like Tom Hardy, you know, these chaps.
Yeah, they come from privileged backgrounds. Yeah. But that's even, I mean, that's acting. And on the artist level, it's even worse.
Oh, is it really?
Because they don't even get paid at all. Like, in a way, when at the entry level, they really don't get paid. But musicians they really need to do it for free. Even they need to pay for it. I mean, a band these days, a young band, there is like the era of, you know, record companies taking an unknown artist and kind of growing them in a way and making their career. That doesn't happen anymore. Like, there's the band and the management who build an audience and invest in it, and then all of a sudden they get noticed when they already have the audience and they get attached to a label or anything like that. So there's much more, it's much more cumbersome for artists to make it, and then you do need to have the resources.
So we were talking about sort of the technical elements of the job. You were talking about audience reach and looking at data. This is quite some time ago. I'm curious to know, when you look, what do you look for? How do you try and understand the audience? Obviously, I don't want you to betray any state secrets here. But if you're looking at trying to grow your audience, what are the sorts of questions you ask yourself?
So the sorts of questions, well, these days, because of the way these platforms, the digital platforms work, I think you need to be guided by the way you can target people. So what you think is, okay, so what are these people most likely to be interested in,
mm-hmm.
right? Across the board, because you're not in a vacuum, and these people will, I don't know, like watch Netflix and be interested in a writer and a musician and a filmmaker or some type of film. And kind of you start building a picture, right? With the available sets of data that these platforms offer. Then secondarily, you look at, well, you look at geography.
Yeah.
Geography is quite, is very important, actually, because, well, particularly if you're working in the kind of live entertainment, or galleries and museums, because there are some massive barriers that are, you know, distance is one of them, we like it or not, together with, you know, price and other barriers.
So what would be an example? What would be the counter example of that then? So.
So if you got a film,
okay, which
kind of national anywhere. Release,
yeah.
Then okay. You got, but again, geography is important because you got the national level.
And that little town in Italy wouldn't get the film.
That little town wouldn't get the film, though. or, you know, you might have something global, like, you know, that video that I mentioned before, This is America and Childish Gambino, he's got a global market. He's putting his video on a global platform like YouTube, and then he's got local distributors or people. Or actually, he's got a global distributor, which is, you know, you can listen on it on Spotify. Although those deals are territory based as well, but you don't see it. You feel like it's available everywhere.
Yeah.
At least in the Western world. Geography, and then secondarily, you look at demographics, but. Not really. But that's where you start. But the most interesting bit is actually once you started running the campaign, and these tools give you data back based on the kind of people that are, the groups of people that are engaging with what you're putting out, the message you're putting out. They're engaging the most, or they are, we say, converting the most, meaning they're actually buying ticket. And that's why I chose this sector, actually, that I'm actually mainly... promote stuff that people want to know about and want to find out about, want to be told about.
Yeah.
I feel like I don't really, hopefully don't really bother anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So it goes into the machine, they start serving these ads, and then certain people start clicking on it, for example. And after a couple of weeks collecting data, it will go, oh, you know, the people who are clicking on this are... actually more interested in this group of interests.
Yeah.
And also they happen to be, I don't know, 25 to 35 year old males, okay. Right? Most likely. So then it will start serving to more of those people, those kinds of people, right? Or it would be because people don't really click on anything, most people. But they get served this ad and then they end up buying a ticket, for example, or buying a product or whatever. So the machine connects the two and it goes, okay, this lots of people are actually buying more. And it could be two different, so the people who click the most and the people who buy the most could be different groups.
Ah.
Because there are people who are more likely to engage but not buy, or buy and not engage. So there is that. So you can see these things, and then the machine again, will, because we're living the matrix, it will optimize, it will help you. And this is done in a way that, so a computer can do it, but a person would take forever, like years. You couldn't in a lifetime make those type of calls. So that helps you spend your money most effectively. So reaching the right people, which is what all advertising sets out to do. Mm-hmm. And it works particularly well when you are working with these valuable niches that I mentioned before, because it works particularly well if you don't have to reach a mass market. Like, there are other formats, actually, that are still better at reaching a mass market.
Like what? Billboards, TV?
TV.
Yeah.
And billboards, yeah. But TV is still the queen, king, whatever, of mass reach and return. So, yeah, that's how it works.
Okay, so thanks for that. So if you were to compare programmatic, which is like the top of the evolutionary tree at the minute, before, presumably before machine learning starts to eat everything.
Well, no, machine learning is part of programmatic.
Is that part of programmatic? Yeah. Then I've not understood.
But, well, this whole thing that I just described with, you know, the ads being served and then the machine learning.
That's completely automatic. That's not.
That's completely automatic.
Oh, right. Now I get it. Okay.
Yeah, it's all automated.
Okay. Oh, I figured that you guys looked at information coming back, ran some spreadsheets, said.
No, we see it happening. I mean, you can change it. You can influence it. But as I said, it's so quick and it's so much data that you wouldn't be able to make anything manually.
Right.
If you had to make all the calculations and all that stuff.
So there's a thing then. So we were just bemoaning the skills shortages in this industry to make this happen.
Yeah.
Won't at some point the skills be unnecessary? Or what's going to happen next in this field?
The skills might be unnecessary. You would still need... So the skills, you still need the skills to, like, the very technical, like IT skills, to set up the machine correctly.
Yeah.
Set up the campaigns in the machine, in the software, and make sure and support it, kind of maintain it. Also, because all the, I mean, we haven't mentioned, but the thing you mentioned before, you know, the saints, they're like, I waste 50% of my advertising budget. I don't know which 50%. I mean, even with all of this happening, we're talking about now we're wasting maybe, I want to say 30% still.
Still that high?
Probably 35, 40. You know what I mean? It's when you talk like big brands and all of that, it's a big improvement, but it's nowhere near being the magic bullet that actually all these companies in the market will tell you they have to offer. And going back to the skill set, is like there's so many companies in the market that offer this programmatically, programmatic, for example. There's so many companies. It's so fragmented that even just to know who to use takes a lot of testing, which means money, which means time, which means people. So we're still really at the beginning, in a way.
Mm.
And hopefully we'll get to a point where it will get easier, because only the strongest will survive. Only the ones that have proved that they're actually functioning, like which has happened with Facebook and Google, because you know, people were getting results.
Yes.
So they kept using that rather than other channels.
Okay, so earlier on you kind of volunteered London, right, as a being a destination for somebody in your line of work.
Yeah.
Which is grand. So I mean, what's the difference between the London industry and the scene as compared to say Rome, Berlin, Paris? What's different?
What's different is that there's a much more entrepreneurial approach to the sector, both in culture and entertainment. It's much more of a defined and structured industry. So the creative industries here are effectively an industry, like a sector, a real sector of the economy, mm-hmm. with real professional roles and careers. In Europe, in continental Europe, it depends country from country to country, but there's generally it's very heavily so culture is very heavily nationalized in a way and funded directly by the government or the local authorities, and but at the same time, so there isn't much of an entrepreneurial approach because there isn't this clear policy, this clear audience development policy that I mentioned before. So yeah, although it's paid by the tax payer, there isn't really this drive to make it as accessible as possible and engage as much as possible the population.
So do you see empty museums, empty galleries?
No, the museums are full of tourists.
Ah, yeah.
It depends where you go. But you know, you've got a place like Italy, which has, I mean, I keep remembering this number. I'm not even sure it's right. I read it once, so should be.
Well, we'll pretend we're at the pub.
We got, yeah, which we're pretending, I guess, to be. But
yeah,
it's got 75% of the kind of capital heritage of the world.
Wow. It's almost as if it's the remnants of a predatory world empire.
Almost, right? You would think, yeah. But then Italy ruled the world twice in history.
On.
It was like, I'm going to say this thing. It sounds so fascist. So it was the Romans, but then during the Renaissance, was the banks.
Yeah.
The so it's lacking this approach. So they got museums full of tourists, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they've got the professional roles there in Italy are curational. So, but curation as in, art historians, artists to maintain the heritage capital.
Yep.
So the statues, paintings, you know, fix them, keep them alive, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all more like, you know, stored in some place, just displayed there, and there's no active use of this culture, of this heritage. There's no activation, right? Because all the money, there's a lot of money spent on just preserving it for humanity, right?
Makes sense.
So that's part of the issue. So you don't have this, the industry, you don't have, it's very much civil service. Meaning also that the way it works in Italy, you know, you're not like, so I worked for the Barbican Centre, right, for the City of London, effectively. I was an employee of the City of London. But I did an interview, so I sent a CV,
yeah.
I was interviewed, I got the job,
yeah,
right? In Italy, to get into a civic museum or like, you know, local authority in the cultural department or like a national level or national museum, there's a nationwide competition.
Ah, it's like our fast stream, right? It's like the civil service entry process.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Which also means that, I mean, in the past, it meant that, or people get moved, normally this happens as well, they move from department to department within the civil service, and they end up in cultural department.
Oh, okay.
Without having any skills.
Yeah, or no
or like, knowledge related to
knowledge.
That. You know, they're administrators, you know?
Yeah.
So that happens. So anyway, there's been, for the past, you know, I think I graduated arts management now, what, 11, 12 years ago.
Where did you study?
In Bologna.
In Bologna.
And the oldest university in the world.
Oh.
And for 11 years, I've been hearing about, you know, ways to be a bit more entrepreneurial or bring, you know, these management skills into it. It's just never happening. So that's the main difference. And the same thing is in France is heavily funded by the state, Germany. And there's this feeling that all they do, and this is, I've been talking to people in those countries and, I've been recently actually interviewed for a book that a German professor is putting together about that and about bringing some of the things that we do in the UK and in London in particular.
Do you want to plug the book?
I don't know what it's called. I've just been interviewed for a chapter, but I don't know.
Okay.
I think it's coming out in the autumn. Yeah. But it's kind of academic study for the sector there. So there's an understanding within the people who study or in the industry that this, it's happening that way. But, and then there's this need to, but the need comes with great investment because, to have that infrastructure, you need to invest in it. And even just having a marketing team, even a small marketing team is going to cost you and a proper marketing budget, you know, advertising budget, promotional budget, PR, whatever. It's going to cost you a lot of money. So I'm not sure when that's going to happen. So that's why I chose, London. And London in particular, even the difference with the rest of the country is that you've got this, micro system, which, I mean, London is effectively a small country.
Yeah.
The South, London and the Southeast.
Absolutely.
So you can, you run almost a national campaign, you know, every time, and you've got this massive pool of people, but also at the same time, you've got this greater competition. Because there are thousands, I mean, tonight in London, if you pick up, you know, if you look at Time Out or if you look online, there are thousands of events going on just tonight in London.
Yeah.
So that mixture of competition and opportunity, because there is a massive audience, I think gives birth to then this whole industry behind it, you know, that tries to push this product or that product.
So it's partly what I'm hearing is it's partly a policy funding thing that allows a bit of that permits there to be an absence of dynamism outside in Europe somewhere, right?
Yeah.
And the fact that here in this big city, this great big city of ours, we have a network effect. We've got millions of people together. We've got loads of cool stuff happening. So therefore, more cool stuff happens.
Yeah.
So it's a dynamic market to be in. So having said that, though, in a big market like the London market, where stuff is going to be expensive to set up, rents are high, stuff's going to be expensive to promote, but you've got to pay people.
Yep.
Does this free market emphasis, as opposed to the European funding model, does the free market emphasis kill creativity at all?
I think it can, yeah. I mean, obviously, we've seen as the funding, kind of public funding, gets cut, you got greater need for commercial success.
Yeah.
Which means you need more, as I said before, populist, like commercial, rather than, and less risky, right? Experiences. The same thing actually happens with the movies, because that's an entertainment, that's a commercial world, and as we've seen in the past, the financial crisis of 2008 has really started this race, this all superhero race, in a way, in the movies, because as money gets tight, they produce less risky. Movie studios have been producing fewer and bigger films. The whole independent film industry has been decimated, and because there used to be, there used to be big budget films, and there used to be medium sort of little kind of budget films, and then there used to be small budget films. Now, this is what I hear and what I read is like there's big budget films and there's small budget films.
Mm.
There's nothing in the middle anymore. Mm. And that used to be the independent scene, like the Steven Soderberghs of, you know, and
yes.
and Miramax, which is not very popular at the moment. But with that monster of Harvey Weinstein,
a producer,
producer. But that's the space he inhabited, right? That middle space, which was big enough, but small enough. So yeah, with lack of money, with tighter budgets, with and also tighter budgets in the audience for culture in general. You know, the DCMS a couple of months ago released the data. The visitor data for the National Museums for 2016, and it was the first decrease visitors in 10 years.
Wow.
In London. And that has to do with the cost of traveling into London from outside, because a lot of the audiences are actually home counties or kind of domestic tourists mm-hmm. into London. Obviously, the threat of terrorism has got to do with it. But people are moving, are visiting central London less often than they used to. Also, there's more, again, back to the competition, there's more local offering.
Okay.
So people tend to stay more local.
So that's a good thing, I guess. I mean, feel a bit too biased towards London. So that's good news.
But even in London, even within London, like people tend to just stay more. If they leave east, they tend to stay east. And before they had to travel. Because there was nothing there. There were no venues, maybe. But anyway, so what that does, though, is it does kill the sort of effects, at least the research and development side of the industry, which is the fringe, which is the, you know, the small venues, the small artists, the small filmmakers, which don't have the opportunities they used to. There's a big, for example, and there are other pressures on this, because music, live music, has been in the news for a while. You know, there's a real threat in loads of small music venues, even historical ones, that have seen the likes of, you know, Oasis and, you know, Blur, or like that started there. Have been closing down because of development, as in building development.
As in knocking down these historical venues?
Well, no, as in building around them, for example, and then having their license withdrawn because
of the neighbors. Pollution.
You know?
Oh, horrendous.
Yeah, well, there's been a lot of that, to the point that the mayor of London last year appointed a nightlife czar. To try to safeguard, to try to protect this network of venues and the whole nightlife industry, which is under threat by these rules and, you know, these developments, and, like noise levels and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And we've seen, you know, even national museums and galleries, you know, they've been more and more reliant on blockbusters. In fact, the DCMS figures, what they told us is that they didn't have as many blockbuster exhibitions in 2016. So they didn't attract as many people. And blockbuster shows are, you know, those classics kind of hits that, you know, your impressionists or that have had centuries of, promotion in a way.
I mean, I think 2016, Big Monet at the RA. Wasn't that in 2016?
I think there was, when was Hockney? Tate? It was last year.
Oh, yeah.
No, 2016. Can't remember. But anyway, those big ones. I mean, Hockney was quite an interesting one because it's a big name, but that was quite a surprise success as well.
Yeah.
But it definitely limits the way the risk that you can take, and culture is about risk, and creativity is about risk for an industry that, as we said before, has got a massive economic impact, and more than actually other European countries, for example. I mean, the UK is one of the biggest exporters of creativity in the world. And with that comes, you know, we know the soft power of, you know, the United States have been.
It does always seem to me that for such a relatively small country, there does seem to be a lot out there.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's a real concern, I guess, because now with Brexit as well, you know, and there has been, and London in particular has been this hotbed of. This melting pot and of the best creative minds, you know, coming to London for the past 20 years or before then, you know, like forever.
Yeah.
For a long time. And now being seen, and I know already, you know, by also talking to people, but like reading stuff, you know, being seen as not as tolerant, not as welcoming, and that kills creativity right there, because people can easily go to other places now. Like, you know, they've been for years now going to Berlin, but, you know, you go to Rotterdam. And this is, comes with, you know, in the tech industry as well.
Yeah.
Same thing is happening, you know. So I don't know. So Brexit definitely is gonna Brexit with the cost of living, and all these factors are kind of, you know, sort of the perfect storm is coming for the sector, maybe, you know.
It does feel as though we're segueing into Brexit.
It does.
Okay, so what, why don't we talk about that? So specifically in your sector, you were mentioning the effect on creativity, potentially.
Yeah.
You know, quite apart from all the other sort of intrinsic pressures in the business.
Yeah.
And other... curiously, I'd always imagined that globalization would be a force that would cause pressure on any domestic industry, like in your industry, entertainment, arts and culture. Brexit seems like an anti-globalization movement.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Which is also damaging. You can't win.
You can't live with globalization. You can't live without. It's funny. I remember, so back in 2001, I was 18. And we were, well, before then as well, you know, we were, it was all about the, you know, the social forum. You remember that in Brazil, the no global movement.
Ah, yes.
Back then. And everybody was in that movement was treated as a crazy person. And all of a sudden, and we were talking about the same, what they were talking. I mean, I was obviously, you know, teenager and really into that stuff, and they were talking about the same things we're talking about now, but from a left-wing perspective, and trying to catch it before it became a huge issue, right? Because it was going to affect people's work and, you know, the labor market and the pressures on the labor market and costs of staff and all that stuff and production and all of a sudden, then 18 years later, 17 years later, well, 15 years later, with Brexit, you know, it all came back from the right. Yeah. It's like a circle. It's like we didn't look, we looked on one side and then we got hit by a car trying to cross the road on the other side.
Yeah, so you had the left wing reaction, then you had the right wing reaction. You also had Lexit, of course.
Lexit.
Lexit. So Lexit was the left.
Oh yeah, the left Brexit. Argument. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. But at that point, though, the left had the liberal left had had taken a different approach, which was there was this opportunity, this global opportunity in competition, I guess, but with having a big role for the state to keep things livable. You know, the problem is then when the other guys come in and go, oh, we don't need the state to keep an eye on this. Let's go wild.
Yeah.
And then it goes, oh shit. Now it's all about the Polish plumber all of a sudden. So yeah, funny that. Yeah, but on the sector, Brexit on the sector, I mean, there's got some immediate kind of direct effects, as in loads of work is funded through European funds, European Union funds, and collaboration partnerships across different venues and promoters across Europe. Same thing, that's very similar to what's happening, what will happen with research. You know, again, universities.
Yeah.
They get access by partnering with, two or three partners in different European countries, in different EU countries. They get funding to do research. Same thing with producing, you know, a play in the theater. You got like sometimes a network of like 10 different theaters around Europe to produce one work that then will tour. Which cut the costs dramatically for And you can do better work, and you can pay actors and directors and dramaturgs more, you know.
Amazing. So we're turning our back on that.
So yeah, but yeah. Luckily we got 350 million a week.
Well, that's going to the NHS, I tell you. It's not going to us.
Oh, no. What's going to happen?
What's going
to
happen?
We all need to become GPs since there's a shortage of that.
And plumbers. So what was interesting to me when, you know, when we talked in the past was around about the time of the referendum, I was working for a client in Birmingham. And I'd travel up to this station in Birmingham. It was like a suburban rail station. And I'd come out and I'd noticed there was, I'd never seen these in London, but I'd notice it when I'm traveling around for work, a plaque on the wall that said, this facility has been made possible by funding from the European community, right? Yeah. And that is the only visible sign that we have in this country of anything positive that's done by the EU.
Yeah.
And I remember from conversations that we had that it's not the role or the permitted role of the European Union to advocate for itself in member state countries.
Yeah.
In fact, it's our parties are relied upon to do that.
Yeah. Because otherwise, I mean, can you imagine, like, seen by a certain side, political side, mm-hmm. side as this totalitarian regime, yeah. right? This yeah. supranational totalitarian regime
yeah.
already.
Yeah.
Imagine if they had a propaganda department.
Can you imagine? Can right? you imagine a particularly strange-faced, chain-smoking, pint-drinking man likening yeah. that to something that Goebbels would do?
Yeah, exactly.
With no hint of irony.
No hints of irony. So clearly the EU couldn't do that.
Yeah.
The way it did work was by funding projects that, like cultural projects or like communication projects that would highlight the connection between European countries, I guess. But that was very subtle, obviously. And we're talking about countries. We're not talking about the EU.
Yeah.
Now, the one thing that I, the first thing that I noticed, and my partner is German, mm-hmm. and she noticed it as well when she moved here. For the first time, and it was at uni, again, so I kept hearing people, like, you know, lecturers, for example, people who were pro-European, didn't have any problem with the European Union or Europe, and talk about the European Union as this experiment, right? That was maybe going to work, maybe not.
Oh.
Yeah, it was always treated as, we'll see what happens with this, right?
Right.
And coming from continental Europe, that was completely different. Like, in continental Europe, it's always been, it just is
yeah.
the European Union.
Yeah.
It's no experiment. Like, you know, it's something that we wanted, and it's something that it's inescapable because of the, we're talking about globalization, we're talking about, you need to be a bigger player on the world stage. You have a shared future, and that's the very definition of a nation.
Yeah.
Right? Having a shared future, a shared past, as bloody as it can be, but then again, everywhere else, the same.
Well, you know, there's a particular union that we live in right now that has a very bloody history.
Yeah, and that is amazing because, like, yeah. living in a union, like the United Kingdom
yeah.
itself being a union of states.
Yeah.
And then seeing this other thing, this other institution as this experiment, I was like, okay.
Mm. Hey, Scotland, stay in the Union,
yeah.
the United Kingdom.
Because it's better that
because
way.
Because it's better yeah. to yeah. stay in. Yeah.
So yeah, it made little sense. And at the time I thought little of it, but you know, it just wasn't funny. A funny feeling that, and then looking at the papers and looking at the parties, the political parties that were supposed to, like, you know, the Labour Party. And to be fair, Tony Blair was very vocal about it when he was in Europe.
Yeah.
Not as much when he was here to True. The British public.
Yeah.
So yeah, and that happens across the continent though. It's like every single national government uses Europe as a scapegoat because there's this big thing that is so far away. Again, they can't really fight back. is the perfect target.
It is, yeah.
It's the perfect target for their own shortcomings, right? But with the understanding in continental Europe, across the board, left to right, extremes, that it just is, right? Well, here there was always that underlining feeling, you know, that maybe. And I think that also on the Remain side, you know, today, even, you know, after, you know, those people who wanted Remain, but now they're like, oh, let's make it work.
Yeah, well, you know, will of the people.
That's where it comes from, you know what I mean? It comes from this idea that it was always a test that we were going to see, that the British pub, the Brits were going to see if it was going to turn out okay for them. Mm. So that was number one thing. And again, newspapers, you know, now you get, you know, The Guardian, the likes like The Guardian are very pro-European and they're pushing that agenda for the second referendum and all of that. But then back in the day, they were publishing the articles about the curve of the bananas or stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, there was never really a concerted effort to really sell the idea of this nation, this federal nation, basically, with a shared future.
So do you see the future?
With great problems, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's not perfect at all. But
absolutely.
Which union like that can be perfect? I mean, it is an experiment. But you see unions that have started in much easier conditions, like with basically from scratch, like the United States of America.
Mm.
They haven't had it easy at all either.
No.
That was bloody recently. Wait, it was bloody recently here too, but
yeah. And they have one currency.
Yeah.
Across a huge geographic area.
Yeah.
Across lots and lots of different industries. You've got rust belts. You've got rural economies, almost completely agrarian economies. You've got service based. You've got somewhere in the middle, some industry left.
Yeah. Kind of specialized between the states, yeah. Right?
Sounds very much like Europe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then people move from one state to the other. That's the thing. Like, so I moved here from Italy.
Yeah.
And I never thought, when I moved here, I never thought for a second that I was actually emigrating.
Yeah, interesting.
I was just moving within the union. That's the thing no one really talks about, actually, if you notice, is the con.
Yeah.
On people that now are talked about as immigrants, when really we were all part of the same nation state, in a way.
Yeah.
The same union.
Yeah.
Like if someone from Scotland moves to London,
it's fine.
It's not an immigrant.
No.
Is it?
No.
Same thing. So all of a sudden you go like, oh, well, okay. Well, so it wasn't like that. So you signed all those treaties. We agreed all those things. But your word, your signature is not worth the paper is on, you know?
Yeah. No,
and that is what is going to really affect, I think, this country in the long term.
What, a lack of trust?
The lack of trust. But not on a governmental level, I think, because, I mean, it's politicians, you know, they're just, you know, they lie for a living. So
yeah.
It's not like, you know. But although they put in place, you know, contracts to put in place checks and balances that give you some stability, which is very difficult to do if you have a government that can just flip.
Mm-hmm.
As we see with Italy, you know, where it's incredibly unstable politically and attracts less investments from abroad, for example.
Well, Italy, ironically, was used in the 2011 alternative voting system, AV referendum, as an example of why we should go nowhere near that filthy proportional system.
Yeah.
Because we'll end up, God forbid, like Italy. Rather than thinking we'll end up, God forbid, like Germany.
Yeah.
You know, and it's interesting what you say there about being viewed, you know, this idea that actually you're an immigrant. It's almost as if people have forgotten that it was a two-way right. It was a bi-directional right. They had every right to move and live elsewhere in the EU if they wanted.
But in fact, I was told, I didn't know the history. I was told by someone, actually it was in the 1970s that loads of people from Yorkshire, kind of the northeast of England, moved to Germany and Switzerland, like, to get work.
Yep.
Which is the same thing that happened in Italy. You know, they all went to Germany, well, yeah. And Scandinavia. You know. So well, clearly a two-way system. It just depends, because when you have an economy that grows faster than another economy in a union like that, there are periods where, you know, people flock to naturally to the growing economy because there's just more work available and more opportunity available. But then, you know, in 20 years' time, maybe it switches and then you go all of a sudden the other way around. And you can't know that. You know, because we've really forgotten, but like, you know, beginning of the 90s and the 80s, this country wasn't doing that well, was it?
It's almost as if we want, by having so much control, we want to have a command economy and we want to move away from the wisdom of the market. It doesn't make any sense, does it? Yeah. But yeah, that story about people from the north of England moving over to Europe to work, back to the culture, entertainment and arts thing. So the entertainment end of the spectrum was a TV show called Auf Wiedersehen, Pet. Yeah. Okay. I think there were Liverpudlians who moved out to Germany.
All right.
And they, you know, they were builders.
Yeah.
And it was just about the culture shock and the adjustment that they went through.
Yeah, can you imagine that? I mean, those were the Polish builders that are coming here now.
Yeah.
You know, the Polish and Romanian that are coming here now. It just, you know, the wheel keeps spinning.
It does, yeah.
So you can't really know. And also, like, you know, I don't know if it's very wise to burn bridges that way, you know.
There's a writer I like called Don Reinertsen, and one of his lines is, you can ignore economics if you want, but economics won't ignore you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that might be the case here. So, okay, great. So we've had a nice little tour today across an entire sector. Blimey. Have you got any exciting exhibitions coming up that you want to plug?
Yeah, well, we've got talking about Brexit and politics, we've got at the moment until the 12th of August, 2018. We've got Hope to Nope, Graphics and Politics, 2008-2018.
Cool.
So that covers 10 years of how actually digital is a big part of that, how digital has disrupted political communication. And so it starts sort of from the Obama phenomenon and kind of the Obama poster, which again was a grassroots product.
Amazing.
It wasn't commissioned by the campaign. It was Shepherd's Ferry made it. And then it became viral back then when it was kind of the beginning of kind of social media going mainstream. And up to Trump, basically, and up to today, where you get internet memes and, you know, and you can't believe anything you read anymore.
Even it's more sort of Pepe the Frog featured.
Pepe the Frog is featured.
Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, go Pepe. and then coming up in the autumn, we've got a exhibition about past visions of the future of the home. So how big thinkers, designers, architects in the 20th century had envisioned how domestic living was going to be in the future, and how actually the challenges they were trying to address back then are very real today, and how that affects us and looking at our future.
Great, thank you. Well, I'll put links to those on the site.
Cool.
Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thanks for listening to our extended special edition of London Digital Nattering. Do follow us on Twitter at LDN Podcast, and please let us know how you found this and other shows we've done. Also, please be sure to rate and subscribe on iTunes or your preferred podcasting platform. We look forward to having you with us next time.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.